First of all, if we could look at that map that you all should have or did have at one point. But at the very top of that map of the land of Israel, you can see where Saul is headed over to Damascus. Right? So if you don't have yours, I'll hold mine up closer to the microphone. Can you see it better? But you can see up here, Saul is leaving Jerusalem, which is down here, and he's headed all the way up to the northeast to Damascus. And that is normally, if you're walking and if you're going to stay on the normal road of travel, it is somewhere in the neighborhood of 135 miles. Okay, so again, if you travel, average person covered about 20 miles a day, okay, on the average. Now, some went further, some went faster, some went slower, right? Yeah, it's just the way people are. So everybody's got their own pace. But the point is, it's just, you know, today we would say 135 miles, it's like going to Sioux Falls, right? You know, a couple hours, no big deal, right? For Paul, it's a week, because you can't travel on Sabbath day, right? So you got to plan your schedule appropriately. So if he leaves on Sunday, hopefully he gets there before Friday night, right? Before Sabbath, because if sundown Friday, right? You can't travel. You got to wait till Saturday night. But you understand the point. It's a whole week's worth, right? So here he is, and Luke has already introduced us to Saul of Tarsus in chapter 8. But as you can see at the top of your notes there on page 33, that Luke thinks this is such a significant thing, he's going to repeat it three times. Okay? Now, as you read chapters 22 and chapters 20 and chapter 26, you're going to see some differences, different emphases, and you need to make sure that you have the right presuppositions as you're going along in the book of Acts, right? There are those who would say, well, see, this proves that there's contradictions in the Bible because Acts 9, Acts 22, and Acts 26 are all a little bit different. So we can't trust any of them, right? Well, the problem is not Acts 9, 22, and 26, right? The problem is your presupposition that the Bible could have mistakes in it. Right, you're assuming that God cannot reveal truth accurately. Now, are there distinctions in chapter 22 and 26 compared to chapter 9? Yes, but read them carefully and listen to what Luke is emphasizing and what Paul is emphasizing, because Paul is the speaker in chapters 22 and 26. He was there, right? He was there in chapter 9, so he knows what happened. Luke is communicating, most likely, what Paul told him, right? Because Luke and Paul traveled together a lot, right? That's how we know, by the way, in the book of Acts, in chapters 13 and following, you'll know when Luke travels with Paul. How? How do you know that? Because it says Luke traveled with Paul? No, it says what? We. Okay, personal pronouns, right? First person plural pronouns. We did this. Okay, so it helps you to think through those times. But Luke obviously knew the Apostle Paul well. He knew that he was a descendant of Shem. He was of the tribe of Benjamin. In other words, that was what? The tribe of King Saul, right? And because we had one king, that means the rest of us are better. Right? Even though the other kings supposedly came from the tribe of Judah, right? But nonetheless, we still have this ancestor, Saul, which he gets his name. So in you will hear his name pronounced differently if you're interacting at all in any kind of Jewish context, Jewish literature, talking with Jewish people. His name will be pronounced Shaul, okay, with an H in there, Shaul. We don't bother with that, but just be aware. So he's going on this journey. Look at chapter 9, verses 1 and 2. Now Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord. Let's just stop there a second. Right? So this is not accidental. Right? This is what he's doing intentionally. This is how he is living his life. This is what he lives for. This is what his job is. Right? Now, to make it official, it says that he went to the high priest and asked for letters from him to the synagogues in Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, both men and women, he would bring them bound to Jerusalem. See, so he's not satisfied with just doing this job down in Jerusalem. He's willing to travel 135 miles one way to do this. Okay? So you see the intensity in which he is doing this, and he is seeking permission to make prisoners of both sexes. Probably this is Caiaphas, because we know Caiaphas rules the high priesthood there until 36. The Jewish synagogues in Damascus were under the authority of the Jerusalem Sanhedrin, even though they're 125 miles away. Everybody's tied. You know, this is the old expression, all roads lead to Jerusalem. Right? They don't all lead to Rome. Right? In this instance, they all lead to Jerusalem. Now, according to what we can find from historical records, there were possibly as many as 20,000 Jews living in Damascus at this time. Okay? That's quite a significant number. 20,000 would be like what? Albert Lee is in that neck of the population-wise, isn't it? Something like that. So Worthington is close to 14,000, so somewhere, you know, in that. But that's what's in addition to the Gentile population. So there's numerous synagogues. We don't know exactly how many are there, but there are a plurality of them. And the other point here in these first couple verses is that expression, belonging to the way. And I've given you the other, for instances, where that's used. Years ago, there was a cult of pseudo-Christian cult that was going around, called themselves The Way, and based on this expression. Okay? Ironically, they were not of The Way. They were out of The Way, but that's how they communicated themselves, because it sounded more Christian-y, right? So just, I don't know if that's even around anymore in our time frame, but it says in chapter 9 and verse 3 through 7 that as Saul was traveling, it happened that when he was approaching Damascus, so he's off of our map in the upper right hand corner, so you can't see him there, but he, as he's getting close to Damascus, so he's almost at the end of his journey. Now, that's important because of what happens, not just what happens to him spiritually, but what happens to him physically. This is a mercy of God to blind Saul of Tarsus at the end of his journey rather than halfway through the journey. Okay? Can you imagine making the rest of that journey blind? No, I think that was a kindness, right? To wait till he got there, essentially, and then make him blind. Say, well, making him blind isn't fair. Well, read the rest of the story. But the point is, recognize how God, even in this, graciously extends kindness to this man who is persecuting his church. right? He is threatening to murder these Christians, threatening to put them in prison. Even the women, he is so upset with all of this. And as he was approaching Damascus, suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him, and falling to the ground, he heard a voice saying, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" Notice again the pronouns. Why are you persecuting them? That's not what it says. Okay? Why are you persecuting us? No. Why are you persecuting me? So Jesus takes offense at what Saul is doing and what he intends to do. What you do to the followers of Christ, you do to Christ. Christ so identifies with us that he takes, what's the old word, umbrage. He is bothered, he is offended by what people do to Christians. He takes it as doing it to himself, right? Isn't that what we see, by the way, in Jesus' own teaching in Matthew 25, right? As much as you have done it unto the least of these, my brothers, you have done it to me, right? So there's that identification that the God of this universe would be willing to identify with us in such a way that you do it to believers, you do it to Christ himself. Wow. So I've also put in there for you, this is the first of Saul's six visions that are recorded. So he has this flashing light and this audible voice of Jesus. I don't know if you've ever, you know, anybody ever had that happen while they were traveling? Is that a South Dakota thing? I don't know. But you know, none of us have had this, right? And none of us should expect to have this. Right? This is a unique thing. Here we have Jesus in his ascended glory, revealing that glory on earth. Okay? Isn't that amazing? So this glory of Christ, which is the last of the seven post-resurrection appearances of Jesus that are listed there in 1 Corinthians 15. But Paul says in Acts 26 that this glory, this light that shone around him was brighter than the sun. Now, I got a new flashlight for work. 2,000 lumens. And you thought it was the sunrise the other day. No, it was my flashlight. But, you know, that's a lot of brightness. If this is happening, right, it doesn't tell us at what time of day. It just says suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. Normally you traveled in daylight, right? So as he says in chapter 26, it was brighter than the sun. So this is, some of us are old enough to remember the old touched by an angel thing, right, where the light would, you know, and it's the best they can do with what they had. But there is no physical source of this light, right? This is the glory of Christ. And it shines around him, it flashes around him, which is similar to what happens on the Mount of Transfiguration, right? Which was at night, because the three disciples were sleeping, right? And you see that strobe light effect of the glory of Christ. But not only that, we also hear in verse 4 and 5 and following, we hear this communication. But here is Saul of Tarsus, never having seen the Shekinah glory cloud. Because that leaves in Ezekiel, right? Chapters 8, roughly 8 through 10, somewhere in there, 8 through 11. So Saul has never seen the glory cloud till here. But he doesn't see it in the temple. He sees it on the road to Damascus. So what is the natural response to being in the presence of God? It's exactly what he does. Nobody has to tell him what to do. He doesn't have to go, oh, wait a second. Glory cloud, and my response should be, no, he doesn't do that, right? He just naturally falls to the ground. That is, excuse me, that is a natural thing. I've given you some examples of that. And notice that Jesus knows Saul's name. Now, it is possible. It is I think, more than possible, I think it's probable that Saul knew Jesus of Nazareth. I think they met at some point in time in Jesus' ministry. It's very possible that Saul was aware of the trials of Christ. It's possible that he was involved with the Sanhedrin. Okay? It's very possible. But when Jesus speaks here, Saul, Saul, and I've given you some other examples of this, of how that repetition of that name, obviously it's a Jewish way of doing things, but it's more than just getting your attention, like we sometimes do with young people or children. We sometimes add their middle name on things, right? And it gets their attention. But this is more than that, right? I think it's also a sign of compassion, of, I know you. Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Now, does Jesus know the answer to his own question? Yeah, he does, right? But this is a way of bringing Saul to an awareness of his spiritual death, right? Now, Romans 7, I think, describes that for us in more detail, what the sin was that Saul struggled with, and perhaps his lack of contentment in his heart for material things, as he talks about, you shall not covet. Remember that, Romans 7? Once he grasped that, he says, then I died, right? Then I became aware I was spiritually dead. Because I can't, coveting is not an external thing. There's external evidences of it. But you can covet without ever accumulating things, right? Coveting is just simply the desire for more. And I think that's what we see here. He is not content to stay in Jerusalem and persecute Christians. He wants more. So his covetousness shows up in a slightly different way. Now, Alvin McLean says this, the loss of this leader of the persecution must have been a staggering blow to the Jewish opposition. I mean, Saul is the guy, right? Everybody buys his jersey. Everybody has him on their Facebook account, and he's my hero. Saul is going to be leaving the persecution movement. For when Saul changed sides in the battle and began at once to confound the Jews at Damascus by his preaching of Jesus, proving that this is the very Christ, Luke says that they took counsel to kill him. And understand the dynamic here. This is huge, right? This is the evening news leading the story. This is front page news. This is people know Saul, and now Jesus has conquered. He is conquering him and bringing him over to Jesus, right? Understand this dynamic. So we have the location near Damascus. We have the events, the flashing light, the sound of Jesus' voice. And now we have in verses 5 and 6, Saul's response. And he says, "Who are you, Lord?" Now that word Lord could simply be a polite demonstration of respect, because you would do that with people. You would call older people. You would demonstrate with this title of Kurios, of Sir, of Lord. I think it's more than that, though. I don't think, however, that this is a full theological recognition of all the implications of Jesus' lordship. Right? I don't think it's that. I think this is somewhere in between. Who are you, Lord? It's respectful, but there's a recognition of what's happening. The glory of Christ, the voice of Christ. Why are you persecuting me? There's this identification of Christ. And you kind of get the impression that as Saul is laying on the ground, that there's this the deer in the headlight look, and the swallowing of, you know, the recognition, all that's involved with this intense conviction, all that God has been doing to draw Saul to himself. He has watched the execution of Stephen in earlier, and now we have this. Okay. So, who are you, Lord? How does Jesus answer Saul's question? "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting." Yeah. Jesus knows exactly what he's doing. He's not going to let him off the hook. "You are persecuting me, you're persecuting my people." And all that's involved with that word persecution, it includes death and imprisonment, right? It includes stoning from earlier with Stephen in chapter 7 and early of chapter 8. Breathing out threats and murder against the disciples, chapter 9 and verse 1. So despite Saul's persecution of Jesus, "I am Jesus whom you are persecuting," verse 6. So despite that, here's what I want you to do. "But rise up," because you're laying on the ground, "enter the city which you are close to, and it will be told you what you must do." So Jesus instructs Saul, and he gives him time to process this. "And the men who traveled with him stood speechless, hearing the voice," or hearing the sound, "but seeing no one." And this is one of those things that chapters 22 and chapter 26 you have to understand, that they heard something, but they didn't understand what they heard. Okay, kind of like, again, not to in any way disrespect, but kind of like the old Charlie Brown teacher thing. Okay, you know, wah, wah, wah. And, okay, there's noise, but I'm not getting it, right? Kind of like the dogs and cats look at us and they go, I think dogs understand a little bit and at least care. Cats are like, you know. But these people hear the voice of Jesus, but it doesn't register. It's not for them, right? But they hear a sound. I don't know if, how do you, they see a light. But what is that light, right? So they are aware of the sound, but they are aware of the light, but they don't grasp it. This, all of this is for Saul. So, and the men who traveled with him stood speechless, hearing the voice, but seeing no one. And Saul got up from the ground, that's obedience. And though his eyes were open, he could see nothing. Now, having seen the risen Christ, the glory of the risen Christ, no man can see God and live. But this is a mercy. Say, well, but he's, you can't see. Yeah, but he's alive. He's alive. Remember, well, Old Testament, several Old Testament illustrations of that. So, leading him by the hand, verse 8, they brought him into Damascus. And he was 3 days without sight and neither ate nor drank. So, giving him time to process all that. Yeah, how do you process that? Apparently, slowly, right, is one way. But this is an encounter that Saul obviously never forgets, and the other people do not forget either. So Saul involuntarily is unable to see. He needs to be physically guided. Voluntarily, he is able to stand and walk. He fasts, apparently. He does not eat or drink for 3 days. And he, chapter 9 and verse 11, tells us that he is praying. So, fasting and praying, apparently. Now, maybe his fasting was just sensory overload, possibly. Or it could be voluntary. But he has seen the glory of the risen Christ. He has heard the voice of the risen Christ. You know, people say, well, if I could just see Jesus, here's one. Here's a for instance. Right? And I know what people say, I think, what they mean when they say that. However, look what happened to Saul, right? So, my last point before we get to verse 10, aren't you glad his initial plans got interrupted? His plan is to go up there and arrest both men and women. It doesn't say anything about children, but it's going to impact the families, obviously, right? And to bring them back to Jerusalem, put them in some kind of a prison format, but Jesus stops the persecution from Saul. Now, he does it in a marvelous way. He doesn't do that all the time. But he's doing this, I think we would be safer to say he is bringing Saul to salvation, and by doing so, he stops the persecution. Okay, it's a means to Saul needs to be born again, and that's what takes place here. And the byproduct of that is that the persecution stops, or Saul's persecution stops. Okay. All right. Before we move on, any questions or comments? Verses 1 through 9. Covered a lot. We got a couple, and you both are going to go, oh no, you first. So, take your pick.
Good point.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, if God would just do more miracles, more people would believe. Not necessarily. Right? So, very good point. You had a...
Is that just Paul's plan with Walter? His entire life is we are thinking, everything about a sudden revelation, because he had a revelation, but the 3 days he said, how long was I? Just, there's nothing to compare. I'm ready to kill these people, honestly. He's in prison, then, but someone else.
I'm one.
It's true, it's real, it's yeah. Really real. In 3 days, think about it, can't see.
Right. And therefore praying. It doesn't say what he's praying for, but meditating, praying, yeah, reflecting on, yeah. Good. Anything else? Go ahead.
Yeah. And stuff like that, to where all he has is the darkness that he can't see, and he's just maybe thinking about his own darkness.
Yeah.
And what it is that just happened to him, and that too, and like you said, praying and that. But yeah, that's all he sees. He can't see. I mean, that's all there is for him right
sure.
now. And in that situation, yeah, you would not.
And if he has, but I'm, as I said earlier, it's very most likely he heard Jesus' teaching at some point. It's very, you know, even if it was just the last week of Jesus' life, teaching in the temple, right? But you still have an awful lot of, and whenever Jesus came up, in those times when Jesus stood in the temple and taught, in those early years of his ministry, it's very possible Saul was there. So hearing that teaching, remembering the Old Testament passages, and the Spirit of God taking all of that, it's like, it only took him 3 days. Right? I mean, it's like, well, I would need longer. But that's what occurs. So let's try to get through two more verses here. I think we can do this in our short time here. So there was a disciple at Damascus named Ananias. And the Lord said to him in a vision, Ananias. And he said, here I am, Lord. And the Lord said to him, rise up and go to the street called Straight, which, by the way, is still there. Okay? And it is not straight. But it's called Straight. And inquire at the house of Judas for a man from Tarsus named Saul, for behold, he is praying. Now, just some things for us to ponder. Ananias is a believer who is well respected. We know from chapter 22 and verse 12. But he sees this vision of Jesus. He recognizes him. And he is given two commands. Now, a specific man to a specific house on a specific street. Okay? That's important to remember. And this is going to help fulfill the prediction of chapter 9 and verse 6. It will be told you what you must do. Doesn't say by whom, but now we know by whom. Right? So the vision to Paul assumes the obedience of Ananias. That make sense? Jesus said, you're going to be told what you need to do. But Ananias has not had the vision of Jesus yet. Right? So there's this delay, so to speak, in revealing to Ananias what he needs to know, but Jesus knows that Ananias is going to be obedient. Wow, what a reputation. Not just with people, right? Saul is from Tarsus. That's his birthplace. That it was a large, prominent commercial and educational city, ranked up there with Athens and Alexandria as far as educational. It was an extremely important city. Saul is noted as being in prayer, and he is noted as having seen a vision about Ananias and the restoration of his sight. That's what verse 12 says. And he has seen in a vision a man named Ananias come in and lay his hands on him so that he might regain his sight. So, you know, see, all of this is going on in Saul's life, right? Remembering Old Testament scripture, remembering the teaching of Jesus, this new work of the Spirit of God in his life. And now this vision that occurs, and a specific vision of a specific man with a specific name coming to him, and all of that taking place while he's blind, and God is preparing him. And we need to stop. But verses 13 and 14 tell us what Ananias' response is to that. And it's understandable. So let's not be too hard on him. But at the same time, his response, initial response, is not necessarily stellar. So.